Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama submitted his $3.5 trillion budget plan to Congress today, a 140-page blueprint including more than $600 billion for a universal health care reserve fund. The president will pay for the plan by, in effect, raising taxes on the wealthy and by changing the way the government pays for some health care services. Let's talk about health care in the budget with Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times. And Noam, first of all, talking heads from the right have said that this is the equivalent of accusations that George Bush went to war in Iraq using 9/11 as a cover. They say Obama is using the economic crisis as a Trojan horse to bring in the Democrats a universal health care plan. On the other hand, House Minority Leader John Boehner says he's in favor of affordable care. He just doesn't want taxes in a recession. So how is this going to be received?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that it will precipitate a fairly ideological fight on Capitol Hill and no doubt on the airwaves as well over the best approach to address a crisis that everybody agrees exists in healthcare. It's no secret that that President Obama and other Democrats wanted to create a system toward universal healthcare coverage, though Obama didn't explicitly say that on the campaign trail. And there's no doubt that Democrats are intent on using the government to do that. Republicans, on the other hand, are skeptical, and right. I'm sure will remain so.
Well, and the bill has to get through Congress, so let's take a quick closer look at it. It calls for reducing the tax breaks for American couples who make more than $250,000 a year. Tell us more about how that works.
Well, under current tax law, higher-income tax payers essentially get a tax break equivalent to their tax bracket. So if they make a $10,000 contribution, they pay 35% in income taxes, they get a 35% break on that $10,000 donation. Those in lower tax brackets get a lower tax refund. So those who are paying, say, 15% would get 15% on that $10,000. What the administration is proposing is that those higher income tax payers will only be able to get a 28% break on qualified deductions, which could add up to several thousand dollars more for some of those higher income taxpayers.
Yeah, Obama wants to reduce the rate by which wealthy people can cut their taxes through deductions for mortgage interest, charitable contributions, local taxes, other expenses. So that's obviously going to be discussed. The rest of the money would come from cuts in Medicare. Where does the president propose changing that system?
Well, one of the biggest item is a program called Medicare Advantage, by which private insurers essentially contract with the government to provide Medicare services to senior citizens. That has been a long-time target for congressional Democrats because it typically costs the government 12%, 13%, 14%, 15% more to contract for those services rather than do it in a more traditional fee-for-service arrangement. So the administration proposes to create a new system to essentially bring down the costs to the federal government for contracting with these private insurers.
Well, and is this part of a shift in how the president might view entitlements? The wealthy perhaps should pay more for things like Medicare and Social Security, which would be a big shift.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that this administration views the wealthiest Americans as a class of people who will be asked to foot more of the bill, not just for health care, but as you indicate, perhaps for entitlements. It's very interesting that in the president's health care plan, which he released today, the introduction, the section of the introduction on health care is, I don't think coincidentally, illustrated by a graphic that shows how the top 1% of earners in America are accruing a greater and greater share of the nation's income.
As they get older. Noam Levy covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, this is a conversation I'm sure we're going to revisit. Our first look at the president's new budget. Noam, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, staying with the president's health goals, he made a rather ambitious declaration about his health plan in Tuesday's speech before Congress.
It will launch a new effort to conquer a disease that has touched the life of nearly every American, including me, by seeking a cure for cancer in our time.
Well, while applauding that statement, a growing chorus of voices in cancer research might also add, switch your gaze from cures to early detection. It would seem to make sense. When some cancers, like ovarian cancer, are detected early, 90% of patients have a 10-year survival rate. When the cancer is caught late, only 10% survive. Of course, we can see those late-stage cancer patients, and they break our hearts. It's understandable that most research money is spent on trying to find a cure for them. But why is so little spent on detection? That's the question Wired magazine deputy editor Tom Goetz set out to answer. His reporting appears in the current edition of the magazine, and he joins us from KQED in San Francisco for a look at the state of cancer research. Tom, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. One of your subheadlines on the article is, scientists should stop trying to cure cancer and start focusing on finding it early. It's the smart way to cheat death. Seriously, though, stop trying to find a cure?
Well, you know, the preponderance of the budget that is spent on cancer research, billions and billions of dollars, more than 90% of it is spent on cure-based treatments. These are the chemotherapies, the drugs, the new radiation treatments that are all trying to stop cancer when it's already happened and it's already been detected, which unfortunately is often the situation when people have the slimmest chance of survival. Mm-hmm. So really the opportunity, if you look at it from a systems level, as an engineer would say, when you really want to attack a problem is when you have the highest odds of success. And in the case of cancer, that's early. So that's on paper a clear and kind of glaring opportunity. But in practice, unfortunately, most of cancer research is not spent on exploiting that opportunity.
Well, and you've got some statistics that seem to underscore almost the futility of where the money is going now. Overall, the cancer mortality rate has only fallen 8% since 1975. That's compared to heart disease, which has dropped 60%. But cancers where there is detection, there has been a real drop-off.
Right. And so that is the overall, the first number you cited is the overall cancer survival rate. And the small improvement that we have had in those numbers is because of those cancers where we've had large changes in detection. So first and foremost is lung cancer. People quitting smoking has cut lung cancer cases in half. But for cancers like cervical cancer, the Pap smear, which was invented in the 1950s, has done wonders in making that a cancer that is very often detected in the early stages when it can be best treated.
Right.
Also, breast cancer, when detected early, has very good survival, and we're getting better at detecting that through mammogram and MRI. But the trick is, in many ways, the deeper a cancer is, when it goes into the lungs or when it goes into the pancreas, it becomes very difficult to come up with a test that lets us see the cancer early.
Well, and you say researchers are now refining tests that can pick up molecular whispers in the bloodstream. What do you mean by that?
This is the science of proteomics. And what that means is basically looking for proteins in the blood that are issued or cast off from a cancerous cell. And they become these little trace proteins that float through the blood. And if we were able to identify which exact proteins go with which cancers and come up with tests that can be used on a blood sample and pick up these proteins at the right time, then we would have early detection tests, blood tests, that could be fairly cheap, fairly easy to perform, not very invasive. You don't have to do a biopsy or a surgery, but you could at least have a chance of finding those whispers, those traces of protein that would tell you there's a cancer here.
Well, it gets even more complicated because they may not be telling you. They may be there, and they, you know, researchers may think that they are connected to the cancers, but they may not be connected to the
cancers. Right. So that's one of these riddles that comes up with early detection. So yes, on paper, it looks very easy. But when you actually start to try to make the associations between very specific proteins and very specific cancers, you need to be sure that you're not being led astray by other proteins that are in the blood that are there maybe for another reason. So, for instance, they found a protein that has seemed very promising for ovarian cancer. But when they actually started to look at that protein, it was there because of stress, not because of the cancer. So what was happening was women were going in for a biopsy or a test, they were afraid they had cancer, so their stress level went up, so this protein was cast into their blood. And unfortunately, researchers thought that that was a sign of the cancer, when in fact it was just a sign of nervous patients.
And that's why researchers are looking for a two-pronged detection system, one a blood test, but then a backup screening of some sort. That's Tom Goetz, editor of Wired magazine. Tom, thanks for getting us started.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, remember Tom said if you look at cancer research from a systems point of view, as an engineer, it looks different? Let's turn now to a former engineer who is now one of the leaders in the move to shift cancer research money from cures to causes, to early detection. Don Listwin is founder of the San Jose, California-based Canary Foundation. Don, welcome.
Thank you.
And take us through your thought process, because we know you were working in Silicon Valley as heir apparent. I mean, you were in line to take over the CEO spot at Cisco Systems, and then in 2000, terrible story, you're now late mom, diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Draw the line from that experience to decisions you made.
Well, my mom's 65th birthday, you know, I had a family reunion, and she was complaining of bladder infections, and her doctor had given her antibiotics for them. You know, fast forward, we finally got her into a hospital, and she was diagnosed with late-stage cancer and died a year later despite, you know, everyone's best efforts. And so I, as an executive, I sort of, after you get over the grief of it all, you go, okay, well, I want to help. I had the great fortune of being at Cisco, what I call the right 10 years from 1990 to 2000. And so I had some resources, and I looked around, and I ended up going to Seattle at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center, where the director there, Lee Hartwell, really had come to terms in his career that early detection was a real opportunity and an underfunded one. And so he convinced me that I should help him start a program there, and that's how this all started.
Well, and staying with your mom's story for just a moment more, coming up with a different way of thinking is one thing, but here you had doctors who didn't, I hate to say it, but they didn't seem to be thinking. What would change there?
Well, indeed. I mean, I was very angry at, you know, this primary care doctor had twice misdiagnosed this whole thing. As you learn more about it, though, you realize it's quite commonplace and that, you know, that your normal doc really doesn't have the tools available to do these types of diagnosis. And when you do the research, and it's a bit of an oversimplification, but sort of the soundbite is, you know, if you find cancer early, you live 9 times out of 10, and if you find it late, you die 9 times out of 10. It's the best analogy in my mind is sort of like the weed infestation in your lawn. You get one dandelion, you go cut it out, you're fine. If you get several of them and they go to seed, there's just no way that you're going to be able to contain this. And so for the longest time, I think doctors have been thinking of cancer as single disease, organ-specific, lung or liver or ovarian. And I think we've learned that that's not the case, that there's a network of failures that go on, and it's a very, very complicated disease process. And so while we need to continue to think about that, it's very clear there's an opportunity that if we had a blood test for my mom, that instead of getting antibiotics, they went, holy cow, you have early stage ovarian cancer. She was done with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can take them out. And it's a very simple surgery now. It's an hour or so. It's inpatient. And, you know, you take the ovaries out and away you go. So we're trying to get to this new model where we give tools to the doctors.
Well, right now, there is a blood test for ovarian cancer, CA125, but it's not fail-safe, as we're going to hear. So Don Listwin and his researchers at the Canary Foundation are working on new blood tests and backup screening, as he said. Well, we'll hear about all of that. And later today, saying goodbye, we in the East hope, to snow alerts. That's later. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation about early cancer detection with Don Listwin, founder of the San Jose-based Canary Foundation. In fiscal year 2008, the National Cancer Institute spent $5 billion on cancer research overall, but just 8% of that, less than $400 million, on detection. Don's whole goal is detection, and he runs his foundation like the efficient Silicon Valley engineer he once was, on just $5 million. So, Don, how close are you to reaching your goal?
Well, the vision for what we want to get done by, we're targeting 2015 right now, is a blood test that you would take annually with your annual physical. But instead of it testing the 40-some-odd things, your cholesterol, your liver function, or whatever else, it would be testing and looking for early-onset cancer. And we'd likely have a test set for women and a test set for men because we got different parts. And then if the doctor saw in that test there's a flag that there's a problem, we would then move you to an imaging test The distinction is we really believe there's these new molecular imaging tests, which are different than the anatomical tests, such as X-ray or mammogram, where you actually inject something into somebody, it circulates around, and it latches on to the cancer specifically and has a some sort of light bulb on the end, whether it's radioactive or whatever else. But then we can give the doctor the tool to see exactly where this stuff is. And we believe if we can get that size to about a millimeter, which is pretty small, then it likely hasn't spread and we can likely cut it out. So the vision is to have those tests available for most major solid tumor cancers, or at least going through the FDA process by 2015.
Well, and this two-pronged test you talk about, you know, a blood test coupled with some sort of screening to back it up and see something. What would it be in the blood test that would show the cancer? Is that the biomarker?
That's indeed right. So, you know, the best example of people right now who have some sort of biomarker test, cholesterol is a biomarker. It's an indication of risk. You've heard of PSA for men. It is also a biomarker, although not a terribly good one. So these biomarkers typically are proteins, and when cancer starts working, cell structures change and these unique proteins get put into the blood. The challenge is that when it's very small, they're in very low concentrations. So they're unique. So we have to discover what they are, and then we have to be able to measure, you know, really, really small amounts of them, or the tumor gets too big.
There's been so much frustration, especially with ovarian cancer. It's a pretty despicable illness. And for instance, we were just hearing that there was a protein, prolactin, that was thought to be tied to ovarian cancer, and then it turned out that it turned up in the blood just before surgery, and so it was probably the women were frightened of the surgery, and that might have produced the prolactin. How confident are you that you are going to find something by 2015?
There's one test right now called CA125, and people use that for ovarian cancer, but they only look for it in recurrence because it only works 85% of the time. And what we really need to do is to get that number higher. Now, the question is, how high do you need to get it? Well, if the next thing you're going to do is cut a woman open, you better get the number really high. But if the next thing you're going to do is actually a molecular imaging test to actually see something, then that number can probably be 90 or 95%, and we're getting very close to that. So we really have to think in this A-B thing. And in ovarian cancer, we have these new microbubble technologies that are coming along for seeing ovarian cancer. And that's the thing that's really going to change the system and the model.
Microbubble technologies. Let's hold up here. This is the molecular imaging you were just talking about, as opposed to, say, an X-ray or even sonograms that can't show a lot of detail. And as we understand it, in this new technology, a patient is injected with a chemical agent that finds the proteins on a tumor. And those agents are attached to these microbubbles. So remind us, microbubbles.
Right. Invented in Europe, they're small, inert little microbubbles, and you can ultrasound them, and they will vibrate, and you can, quote, see them on ultrasound. The beauty of that, and so what you do is you put a homing device, that antibody that latches onto the cancer, and you attach it to the microbubble. And you inject it into the woman in this particular case, and in about 20 minutes, you can do an ultrasound. Now, the beauty of this is ultrasound machines are generally available and quite inexpensive versus a PET scanner, which we are doing some technologies which are much more expensive. So we're quite excited about this. We're in the process of helping the company bring things and get it FDA approved, the bubbles themselves. And then we're going to engineer specific attachments to those things. And we have a program in both pancreatic cancer and in ovarian cancer to have these microbubbles so that we can see the cancer.
We also understand that your foundation, the Canary Foundation, is making headway with HE4. This is another blood biomarker for ovarian cancer.
HE4 is another protein biomarker. It's the only one that really has come to market in the last little while. It complements CA125, so it makes that blood test a little bit better.
Is it also a blood test?
It is. Uh-huh. It is, right. And so the whole idea is to make a panel of these, and we think if we can make 3, 4, 5 of them together and build a little black box formula that the doctor doesn't have to worry about and bring out a number, then that blood test will be sufficient that we can then take the patient to the imaging test. And it's really important to give them an additional test. And then economically, it's really important to make sure that we can do this economically and have a cheap blood test first, a reasonably cost-effective imaging test second, and then referred to surgery.
Yeah. Don Listwin is founder of the San Jose, California-based Canary Foundation. Canary, of course, because he's interested in early detection of cancers, as opposed to putting all of his research and time and effort into late-stage cancer. Don, we began by talking about the story of your own mom who died of ovarian cancer. You don't sound like you need a lot to propel you, but is she still propelling you? I'm just wondering.
Well, she is. I mean, she was my best friend, and I miss her dearly. My dad had colon cancer, and my first wife had vaginal cancer. Sadly, my uncle died of prostate cancer 2 days ago.
Oh,
so it's really been across my entire family. But when you get into a biz like this, now I get a call every week, and obviously I'm not a doctor or whatever, but I know a lot of the team members are MDs as well as PhDs, and it's just a horrible disease, so you don't have to go very far to continue to keep motivated on this.
Don Listwin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Okay. Tomorrow on Here and Now, how basketball shaped President Obama. And still ahead today, she learned literally at the feet of Gregory Hines and Charles Honey Coles, tap dancer Jane Goldberg. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former Senator George Mitchell is in Jerusalem trying to re-energize the stalled peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Today he met Israel's prime minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu, an outspoken opponent of negotiations. Mitchell visits the West Bank tomorrow to meet with officials from the Western-backed Palestinian Authority. One of Mitchell's immediate goals is to shore up the shaky, informal ceasefire that ended Israel's retaliatory offensive against Hamas in Gaza last month. Well, George Mitchell is just one of several veteran American diplomats with new assignments. Dennis Ross, who under past administrations worked on the Middle East, is now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's special advisor on the Persian Gulf, including Iran. Richard Holbrook, who helped broker peace between the warring factions in Bosnia, now has a new post in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So everything old is new again. With that in mind, the BBC's Luis Hidalgo prepared this report on the challenges facing special envoys.
There is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, and sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings.
But can they be ended by special envoys? Senator George Mitchell, President Obama's new special envoy to the Middle East, should know. In the 90s, he was President Clinton's special envoy to Northern Ireland and is widely credited with helping to broker the Good Friday Agreement that ended decades of conflict there. Can he do the same for the Israelis and the Palestinians?
George Mitchell was perfect for Northern Ireland, where he basically sat for 2 years and listened to the warring parties. He is a man of great patience and gentleness.
But conflict resolution expert Dr. Mari Fitzduff says every case is different. What works in one conflict might not in another.
Timing and the particular situation that you walk into, it's critical that you match what you can bring to what is needed. For instance, I have heard people in Israel say, we really need someone to push us towards the solution. We know where we have to go. But it is so difficult for people to move, particularly given the divisions within Israel and indeed the divisions within the Palestinians. So that in that sense, you might need somebody who can put some pressure on people to move to the table and make the agreements that, frankly, it's been agreed for many years now they need to make.
So what difference, if any, can a special envoy make? Dr. Brendan O'Duffy has studied peace processes from Northern Ireland to Sri Lanka. He says what special envoys bring is focus and, in some cases, though not all, commitment by the government or organization that sent them to helping find a solution.
Compared to a diplomat who has a wide range of issues, the special envoy can concentrate by being in place for an extended period without being diverted into other issues. Envoys are also useful to signal interest and commitment to a long-term peace process. And once there is a general agreement among the principals in a conflict, then the envoy's skills can be instrumental in reaching a successful conclusion and a deal that sticks and is implementable.
That's the theory, but the record of special envoys over the years is pretty mixed. George Mitchell's success in Northern Ireland and Richard Holbrooke's to some extent in Bosnia in 1995 are more or less exceptions. Take Darfur, says Dr. Mari Fitzduff.
If you look at what's happening in Darfur, we're tripping over ourselves with envoys from pretty well every part of the world. And the difficulty there is that, of course, the conflict keeps changing. No sooner have you got people into a room together that the parties split up, they demand a different kind of talks, and you have to actually wait another period of time. And the conflicting parties just use them against each other and use them to get what they want.
There are a lot of special envoys around the world. The EU, the AU, individual governments all have them. Japan just this week said it was appointing one to Afghanistan. And the UN has more than 30, including three special envoys on climate change alone. Their success or otherwise depends on the powers they have, what they've really been sent to do.
If they bring full powers from their government, they will be paid a lot of attention. And if there are conflicting parties, they will obviously take account of them. If they come, on the other hand, with a watching brief and the idea is just to gather information, they're probably less powerful.
Dan Simpson was appointed US Special Envoy to Somalia in 1994. He arrived in a country with no central government and already mired in war. And he admits his mission was not a success.
My assignment was to somehow get them to stop fighting each other and to put together a government that at least folded in as many of the different elements as possible. I would say that I failed miserably, and the reason I would give is what I consider to be the essential element in all the work of all the special envoys, and that is the time period within which they have to work and the time which they themselves devote to the effort.
So, time is crucial. And that, says Dan Simpson, is the dilemma that governments and bodies like the UN face when they're choosing who their special envoy is going to be. Will that person give the months or the years which Dan Simpson believes are needed to make it work?
I would argue that it takes almost a year and repeated meetings for the special envoy and the parties to the disaccord to get to know each other and to trust each other, if such a thing is possible. And then another year to start moving the pieces around into a position where one might be able to achieve one's objective, and then perhaps the third year to wrap it up. The choice between a highly visible negotiator, such as Tony Blair, for example, and another perhaps less visible one, how much time are they willing to put into it?
Success also depends on resources and staff. President Obama's new envoys, George Mitchell in the Middle East, Richard Holbrooke in Pakistan and Afghanistan, Stephen Bosworth in North Korea, are all likely to have plenty of backroom help. But it also comes down to what the special envoy is being sent to do. Do they have a clear mission, or are they just going to show willing? Mari Fitzduff believes this is one of the main challenges that Richard Holbrooke will find in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
One of the difficulties he will face is that, in fact, nobody is quite sure what the mission in Afghanistan is. I think Karzai is famously known to have said, you know, there's many messengers here, as he looked around at the different envoys, the different armies from the different governments. He said, but what is the message? In other words, what is an agreement about what we're trying to attempt in Afghanistan?
And that's crucial too, getting the country or countries that the special envoy has been appointed to on side. And academic Brendan O'Duffy says there's a limited amount any envoy can do if there's no consensus among the warring parties that some kind of deal has to be reached. Take Sri Lanka and Cyprus.
In the absence of unambiguous positions on the part of principal rivals, Greece and Turkey, in the case of Cyprus, the influence of the special envoy has been limited. In Sri Lanka as well, the role of Norway and various special envoys have also reflected an external consensus on what a deal would look like, but a lack of agreement among the principals in the conflict zone. And so in those two cases, the role of the special envoy has been very limited because of a lack of clear political agreement among the principal rivals in the conflict.
It'll be that agreement, or the lack of it, as well as their own personal styles, that will determine whether or not America's new special envoys succeed in what they're being sent to do.
And that report for Here and Now from the BBC's Louise Hidalgo. And just a reminder, you can always listen to Here and Now stream live. You can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also leave a comment or send us a letter at letters@hereandnow.org. And no surprise, you're listening to Here and Now. It's been quite a winter for some of us. Here in Boston, we had much more snow than normal. Same in Pittsburgh, Milwaukee, which means a record number of snow alerts, which, as you're going to hear, can be so detailed you need to take notes, and which, as you will hear, inspired one resident here to create a remix of Somerville City Official Tom Champion's Robocall Snow Alert.
Hello, this is Tom Champion calling from the city of Somerville with snow alert information for Tuesday and Wednesday, January 27th and 28th. Based on current weather projections, the city will be declaring a snow emergency effective at 12 midnight tonight. During snow emergencies, parking is allowed on the odd-numbered side of the street only unless otherwise posted. Cars not moved from the even-numbered side of the street by 4 a.m. Wednesday morning may be subject to ticketing and towing. After 8 p.m. on Tuesday evening, residents unable to find a parking space on the odd-numbered side of the street may park in any municipal lot or in designated school parking lots. Because snow is expected to begin before sunrise, residents should plan to move their cars before they go to bed.
What? Odd side of the street? Sunrise? Sunset? Something about 8 p.m.? Or was it 4 a.m.? Or midnight? Every town here in Massachusetts has a different approach to snow alerts, and woe to new residents who don't understand them. Cosmo Catalano is a web specialist for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He received the Somerville alert and turned it into this remix, which went from his website to the Somerville community website LiveJournal. Cosmo, when did this inspiration hit you to make this mix?
I was sitting on the bus waiting to ride home, and I was listening to music, and I was listening on my iPhone, and the call just kind of cut in. They came so closely together in my head that, you know, it sort of just came to me.
Well, you went home and made this sort of mix-up. Let's hear a little more of the mixed-up part. Now, Cosmo, it seems that you've hit on a very sensitive issue in Somerville there with that reference to the odd side of the street parking. Tell us about that.
Well, during snow emergencies in most of the city, you're supposed to park only on the odd side of the road so the snow plows can get through and so emergency vehicles can get through. And a lot of people who live on the even side, as you can imagine, aren't too thrilled about that.
Right, because the plows go all the way up to the curb on the even side, and they plow right over your sidewalks.
Yep, sidewalk, driveway, whatever's there.
Well, we understand that people can't quite remember why this rule was put in place. It might be because there might be more parking spaces on the odd side and more fire hydrants there as well, and they want to clear them out. And in fact, the Boston Globe is reporting, I don't know if it's because of your remix drawing attention to this, but they may address this and they may change this. But what about just how complicated it is in general? You know, what do people say to you about that?
It's, I guess, the price you pay for living in a fairly densely populated town. There's not a lot of transit, so people usually need their cars to get around.
Right. There was a time, of course, when cars just got plowed in.
Yeah.
Or people would say, wow, it's snowing, maybe I'll move my car. But now, you know, in many towns here, we have this grand parade of tow trucks that precedes snow plows and systems like yours. Now, how did it work? Did you sign up to get that message?
Yeah, I signed up on the city webpage because obviously I didn't want my car to get towed.
Right. And did you move your car?
Yes, there were forecasts a couple days in advance saying it was going to snow a lot, so I snagged a spot on the left side when they were still available and left it there for a couple of days.
It sounds as if you do most of your driving moving your car.
Yeah, during the non-winter months, there's street sweeping, and they alternate sides every 2 weeks. So I have another email alert set up for that, so I know to move my car so it doesn't get ticketed.
Mm-hmm. Cosmo Catalano, creator of the Somerville Parking Emergency Techno Remix. By the way, did you hear from Somerville City Official Tom Champion?
I did. He sent me an email a couple hours after the remix appeared on the LiveJournal site for Somerville. And he seemed to be a bit bemused with it. He said that it was good that I was bringing this great entertainment to his coworkers, but he said it was bad that entertainment was coming at his expense.
Well, I don't know. I think he has a really nice voice. Let's listen to, again, Somerville City Official Tom Champion, as featured in Cosmo Catalano's remix of the Somerville Parking Emergency Alert. Cosmo, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Now that your feet are tapping, next, the tap goddess of the Lower East Side, here and now. Welcome back to An Improbable Story. A white Jewish girl in the disco era 70s watches old Fred and Ginger movies and decides to embark on a quest to learn to tap dance, not all that common then, and to find her own Fred Astaire, because her mother says it's very important to marry a good dancer. Well, along the way in her quest, she helps spark the tap renaissance that her friend, the late great Gregory Hines, rode so brilliantly to fame. Jane Goldberg was that girl, and she's come out with a fascinating autobiography called Shoot Me While I'm Happy, Memories from the Tap Goddess of the Lower East Side. She ended up pursuing the long-forgotten tappers from the glory days of black show business, tap daddies, as she calls them, who were initially skeptical about teaching her their tricks. Men such as Charles Honey Coles, you may remember him as the MC in the movie Dirty Dancing, John Bubbles, the father of what's known as rhythm tap, Charles Cookie Cook, who became her partner, and the great Stanley Brown. Here and now's Lynn Menegon spoke with Jane Goldberg when she tapped her way into town last fall.
Shuffle down, shuffle ball chain, shuffle down, break. Bop, bop, beep, bop, ba-doop, bop, bop. It's a real listener's art. I mean, it's like jazz. It's like music. Most of the tap dancers who do jazz tap would definitely say they're playing their feet. And they're playing music. It's actually a very unusual art form because you're moving and you're listening. And so it's one of those double whammies where you're paying attention to two things at once. That's what makes it so miraculous, I think. I've been tap dancing since 1973. I started out actually here in Boston with a man named Stanley Brown. Do you want to see one of his steps?
Yeah, I'd love to. Show me.
Okay. I remember all of Stanley's stuff because we had to repeat it so much, which is a big part of tap dancing. So it goes like this. Shuffle, heel, shuffle, ball. Heel, heel, brush back. Shuffle, heel, shuffle, ball. Falap, falap, falap. I forget that name. Shuffle, heel, shuffle, ball. Falap, heel down. Leap, leap, falap, falap. Stomp, stomp. And he was great. I mean, I was so lucky to get him, and he was the only one listed in the Yellow Pages, and, you know, just really gave us these gorgeous rhythms. I still remember Stanley's stuff.
So you moved from Boston to New York. You were going in search of the great tap masters that you know exist out there, so you can find them and learn from them. No one really has done this before. You're like an anthropologist.
Yes, like an anthropologist.
You're an anthropologist.
Right. These acts had great names, Buck and Bubbles, Chuck and Chuckles, Tip Tap and Toe, the Three Chocolatiers. I mean, when I started hearing those names, it was like, wow, who are these people?
You got to New York and you called Charles Honey Coles for 4 months every day.
Yes. I was very persistent. And his wife always answered, and she was a dancer too, but she didn't tell me she was a dancer in the chorus line of the Apollo. And she just said, you know, he's not home, he'll be back. And finally he said to me, yeah, I'll meet you. And that was like, I don't even remember being nerve-wracking because I had such chutzpah then. I didn't know he was like the greatest in the world. You know, Stanley had given me his name, but Honey was like tall and 6'6" and just very, very handsome and distinguished. And he liked spaghetti, but he never gained any weight. But he just had beautiful feet and just gorgeous sounds. This is the Shim Sham, which is what every tapper really has to know. This is our tap national anthem. This is a half break. Beep, bop, beep, bop. Now everybody has bop, beep. This is Honey Cole's ending. Yap-a-deep, bop-a-deep, bop-a-deep, bop-a-deep. You know, I was influenced by a man named John Bubbles, and he was considered the father of rhythm.
And rhythm is dropping the heels. Now explain that. Is that right?
Rhythm tap refers to the fact that Bubbles put it in the jazz bracket. So when he dropped the heels, it sort of made the syncopations happening. Before, tappers were like, Bill Robinson were way up on the toe, and they didn't have a whole lot of syncopation. But when Bubbles, he created a whole style that really influenced all the generation of the men and women that I'm writing about in my book, which is that they began to do these rhythm taps where there weren't names of steps. Like Stanley Brown, when I just said shuffle heel, shuffle toe, that wasn't the way I learned it really from the rest of them. Most of them went yop, yop, doobity, yop. This is Honey Coles. This is how he taught it. Yop, yop, doobity, doobity, yop, doobity, doobity, yop, 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 beepada, deepada, deepada, da. And you actually had to look at the feet and watch it and hear it. And
try and duplicate it when you're learning.
Totally duplicate it. And one thing I loved about tap was that these, older black men did not care what I looked like. All they cared about was the sound. So it was a very unself-conscious form of dance where it wasn't about the body. And that's why they call it hoofing. It's because you don't really care. You're a hoofer because that's not what you're focused on. You're focused on your sound. You know, what I did was take a lot of these old master rhythms and just made them my own. And that was their encouragement, was to create your own thing, to be an individual.
What's your sound?
Well, that's a good question. Like, I do rhythm and schmooze.
This is your...
This is the kind of act that I do. I start out... I like to talk. Doop-a-dee-bop, ba-dee-ba-dop, ba-doodly-yop, ba-dee-ba-dop, ba-dee-bop-bop. I like to tap, boop-a-dee-bop-bop, ba-doodly-yop-bop-bee-bop. I like to tap while I talk, boop-boop-boop, ba-doop-ba-doop, ba-dee-ba-dee-ba-dee-bop-bop-bop, ba-dee. I love to talk about tap. And then it goes into this whole thing of everybody thinks tap dancers are happy people with happy feet. Well, I've been tapping for 30 years straight, and I'm still depressed. And that's like my punchline of, like, I know if I'm dying out there if the audience isn't laughing at that point. And so I have to go into something else, like, you know, the history of tap. One of the things that depresses me is that a lot of people want to know how tap dancing began. And it's not that they really want to know that. They want to know who does it the best and who gets the credit. And so I got so tired of being asked the question that I finally said, well, the Jews started tap dancing. It was all those years running through the desert that gave us this incredible rhythm. And I always wondered how I became the tap goddess of the Lower East Side. Lower East Side, Lower West Side, all throughout the map. Someone's saying the rumor that Jews invented tap, bop, 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 black and white together. I do a turn here, the Irish can take a walk too. Don't forget, tap was begot by the wandering of a female Jew. So that's the origins of tap.
And tell me about the title of the book.
Shoot Me While I'm Happy. Yeah, that's actually from an expression that Cookie Cook used to use when we worked together. And he did it between the third step of the shim shim, like we'd go from... And instead of the break, he'd go, shoot me while I'm happy. And it was actually an expression that was a vaudeville expression. And... to me, it just means, I mean, it sort of says it all, that, you know, I want to go when I'm happy. And I've kept it for the many years that I've been writing this book. But John Bubbles, I remember, said, that's old-timey. Call it Pay Me While I'm Able.
Jane Goldberg, author of Shoot Me While I'm Happy, Memories from the Tap Goddess of the Lower East Side, speaking with Here and Now's Lynn Menegon. You can link to Jane's website at ours, hereandnow.org. Okay, everybody dance. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Now I'm going in a Bubba Gain circle. Big finish. Ya ba da ba da ba ya ba da ba ya ba da 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 da.